Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
British singer-songwriters, performers, musicians, Hi-Fi Sean and David McCulmont release their sophomore album Daylight in 2024. It follows their acclaimed 2023 debut Happy Ending. David McCulmont is a British vocalist, essayist and art historian. He came to prominence in the 1990s as a singer, particularly through his collaboration with Bernard Butler. David continued to be part of the entertainment and music industry throughout his career. And in 2010, he returned to academia, working with the University of Leicester and the Architectural Association School of Architecture. Sean Dixon, also known as Hi-Fi Sean, was part of the Scottish alternative rock band The Soup Dragons of the late 1980s and early 1990s. Named after a character in the 1970s children's television series Clangers, the group is best known for its cover of the Rolling Stones song I'm Free, which was a top 5 hit in the United Kingdom in 1990, and Divine Thing, a top 40 hit in the United States in 1992. Hi-Fi Sean took a break from creativity for a number of years and then decided to dive back into the entertainment industry with a number of different projects and collaborations. Up next on Celeb Savant, discussing each of their journey in the entertainment world and their latest project, Daylight, is Hi-Fi Sean and David McCulmont. Sean, where do we find you in the world and how are you doing?
I'm in East London and I'm fine, thank you.
David, where are you at?
I'm in South London, same, fine.
Okay, lovely. So, Sean, why the choice of the name Hi-Fi Sean? Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from my second band after the Soup Dragons. I started a band called The High Fidelity. Mm. And we all had email addresses, which were like Hi-Fi Sean, Hi-Fi Paul, Hi-Fi Ross, Hi-Fi Adrian. And when I started a club in Glasgow in the early 2000s, my friend Alan that I started the club with had a name. His DJ name was Hush Puppy. And he said, you can't just be called Sean Dixon. You need a name. And I'm like, can I just be called Sean Dixon? He's like, no, you need a name. And he said, use that thing you've got. Because back then, email addresses, not everybody had them. So my email address became my DJ name.
Okay. Lovely. Brilliant. So now heading to David. David, your journey in the entertainment music world, at what age did you decide, cool, this is the space you want to be, whether as a child or teenager? And your hybrid journey in the music entertainment world, how did that progress?
I think that my sister was a performer and I always wanted to ape my sister. You know, whatever my sister did, I wanted to do too. I think it's why I'm interested in art as well, because my sister is a painter. She's 2 years older than me. And then there was the church, the congregation, leading the congregation in song. So I participated in that. And then growing up in England, you know, Top of the Pops, Michael Jackson, when we were all teenagers, Prince, Purple Rain, really, really formative, because there was a difference between growing up with an interest in music here until I was 11 and then transferring to a country where most of the music that we heard was coming from the American chart. And then I came back to the UK. And when I came back to the UK, I was still a born-again Christian. I accepted Christ as my personal savior when I was seven, when I was 13. So I'd been like singing in church for about 7 years by the time I got back here. And then I decided to come out. And I thought, well, if I'm going to come out, I can't be in the church anymore. And so I left. And I needed something to fill it. And by then, a few people had heard me singing and said, don't give up the day job. But then there were the others who were like, oh, you should really do this. And so I thought, okay, well, let's have a go. And I opened up the Melody Maker and there was an advertisement in the back of the Melody Maker. I've never forgotten it. It said, wanted singer for band, black, white, male, female, gay, straight, doesn't matter. And I thought, right, that's the gig. And I met this brilliant musician called Saul Freeman, and we started Thieves together. And then after Thieves, Bernard became Free, and we started McCallum and Butler together. And then people like Craig Armstrong and David Arnold and Michael Nyman got in touch in the interim years, and I did a second album with Bernard. And then I joined Facebook because I didn't know what to do next, and I became friends with this guy called Hi-Fi Sean, and I had no idea who he was. And I thought it was quite odd that every now and then he kept mentioning the Soup Dragons. And I thought, well, this bloke really likes the Soup Dragons. And then one day I realized, oh my God, he is a Soup Dragon. But he was DJing. So he wrote me a letter and said, a direct message and said, do you want to do something on my FT album? And I said, yes. And it's funny because that song, like Josephine Baker, listen to all the stuff that we write now. It's sort of become a template. We seem to spend a lot of time in outer space. You know, there's always like a spaceship or something nearby. And yeah, no, it's just a really fantastic musical relationship. So we've just finished recording our third album. It's just fantastic music. Sean's a great producer, arranger, songwriter, and he's full of surprises. We're talking about Daylight, we're promoting Daylight, but we've just done Twilight, and I mean, once again, in a very short space of time, he does something that I don't anticipate, that's like really stunning, and it just really gives me a lot of room to maneuver and breathe and express. So yeah, no complaints about about our musical relationship at all.
Sean, over to you.
Oh my
You were
God, have I got to tell the whole story?
just a hybrid
Jesus.
version at what age and the various iterations that you've been part of.
Okay, so I come from a small working class town called Belsall, which is about 12 miles outside of Glasgow. I come not from a musical family at all, not from an artistic family at all. I come from a family where my dad was, he was a football manager for a while. He trained football teams. I was surrounded by boxers because my uncle was a really famous boxer. My great uncle was a world champion boxer. So my whole family was all about sport and boxing and football players in the living room. Every time you went in the living room, there'd be football players shouting at the TV. So my little escape from all that was Top of the Pops, you know, and Tomorrow's World. People never say Tomorrow's World because Tomorrow's World was before Top of the Pops. So that mixture of, you know, science and science fiction and music, I suppose, is where it all comes from for me. That bond, you know, Tomorrow's World was saying, this is how you're going to listen to music in the future, and showing a CD. And then Top of the Pops was on, and I remember it was all just one big thing for me. And when you're young, I mean, my mum started noticing that I played a lot of records. I got a record player when I was 5 years old, because in my town, the place where you went to get your hair cut, the barbers, was actually a record shop as well. So my dad realized the only way he could get me to get my hair cut was to buy me a record. So he used to take me every few weeks to the barber's and let me buy a record after I got my hair cut. And the first album I ever supposedly, I didn't buy, but I chose because I liked the cover. Because usually when you're like that age, you just go, oh, I like that, I like that. I chose a Burt Bacharach album as my first ever album. It's Jackie DeShannon's "What the World Needs Now Is Love" by, you know, produced and made by Burt Bacharach. Then they realised I was more obsessed with sitting in my bedroom, being a loner, playing records than, you know, hanging about. And my dad and mum decided to send me to guitar lessons, which was annoyingly every week at the same time Top of the Pops was on. That's what I always hated. And on that street was a guy called Norman Blake, who went on to be in the Teenage Fan Club. But I never knew Norman at the time. But it's that thing when you're young, you kind of see people that look like you or kind of dress like you. Or, you know, before social media, you had to clock people out and go, right, okay, you're in my world. So in my small town, I realized, oh my God, there's this guy that kind of looks like he's into women. And he thought the same about me. And then we got talking and we started hanging out in each other's bedrooms, listening to each other's records and things. And then we met this guy called Douglas. So yeah, that's how all the band things started in Bells Hill, which is incredible because there's even now movies about that scene, the Bells Hill scene. There's a movie called Teenage Superstars. We used to put on parties at the local hotel and just try to be as kind of left field as we could in our small town. And, you know, and then we realized there was other people like us. So we created this like-minded unit of people that we would hang out with. And then that kind of transposed into hanging out in Glasgow, which was 12 miles away. We started, you know, going to concerts like the Jesus and Mary Chain and the Pastels and all that stuff. And we started creating a family with that world, so the Glasgow and Bells Hill thing. And it just became bigger and bigger. And at the age of about 16, 17, I started the, I think it was 17, I started the Soup Dragons. We'd only been together for 2 weeks when we got our first concert. And I'd never actually sang down a mic before until that night that we played. We played with Primal Scream at a party called Splash One, which is now a really infamous kind of indie party that happened, indie rock and roll, psychedelic, whatever you want to call it. And we made a flexi disc that cost something like £30 to make, a thousand of or something ridiculous. Our bass player put it on his fanzine. NME made its single of the week, which I've never done for a flexi disc. And the next minute, I've got John Peel phoning me up at home. I was still living at home, and John Peel asking us to be on the John Peel session. And then it just all kind of exploded. And then a few weeks later, the manager or ex-manager of Wham, one of the two managers, Jazz Summers, invited us down to London, and that's where I met Jazz and Tim, who. You know, who became our managers. And that went on for a good many years. We ended up, you know, with records on, we actually got on Top of the Pops, you know. So yeah, your dream comes true. We did Top of the Pops three or four times. And then we had a hit record in America, which was a lot of fun. And we traveled coast to coast to America for about 2 years solid. And then that band disbanded. And I went on to start a band called the High Fidelity. I worked with Bollywood orchestras, did lots of amazing things. And then about the age of 2000, year 2000, 2001, I made an album called the Omnicord album with the High Fidelity. And weirdly, that was the worst year of my life when I came out and had a almighty, whatever you want to call it, my brain shut down, and I never really made another album for 15 years. And the next album I started to make was the album which I luckily met David, and that album was me just trying to find my feet and my confidence of making records again. So the concept was just to ask lots of people that I really respected, because I wanted to. If you look at everybody on that album, they're all very unique to what they do, and I wanted it to sound like that. I just wanted it to. I was kind of an experiment in my head. I wonder what it would sound like if I could work with somebody who's so uniquely them, if it still sounds like them, and if it still sounds, and will it sound like me? Because I didn't even know what me sounded like at that point. I hadn't done anything for so long, and it was an amazing journey. It lasted for about a year and a half making that album, and it just started growing because everybody I kept asking said yes. And it was like the classic one David said to me when we met. He said, "So who would you want on this album then that you haven't asked?" And I literally jokingly said, "Yoko Ono." David turned around and went, "I know somebody that knows her." And then before I know it, Yoko Ono agreed to be on the album. There was a few people I did ask, obviously, that, you know, either basically or they weren't interested, but. To be honest, 90% of people that were, you know, I put forward to said yes, and created lots of friendships from it as well. You know, to this day, I'm still really good friends with Fred out at the B-52s, and worked with him again, and you know, Billy Ray Martin and Maggie from Scarlet Fantastic, who's a close friend. So it's really nice that music sometimes can bring you close friendships as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so now let's unpack this latest album, Daylight, that is coming out shortly. It's the two of you together, obviously. What invigorated the songs? How did they come to be? How long is the journey in creating it? David, you first.
You know, it depends on what day it is. At the moment, the story is, or the way that I like to tell it, is that when we started conceiving Happy Ending, we had a working title, and the working title was Space Age Soul, which to me just sounded like dystopia. You know, future is dystopian. And so we ended up making, I think, a dystopian soul epic. It's dystopian, a psychedelic dystopian soul epic. And so when Daylight came around, and I'm Sean had this idea about a summer album and a winter album, you know, Daylight just sounded like brightness and sunshine. And Sean said that he felt that we should do a load of bangers, just an album of bangers. I don't know if that was his kind of subconscious response to the dystopian aesthetic of Happy Ending, but it's like, you know, so what I'm saying about Daylight is is by the people who made Happy Ending, but they got over it.
Sean?
I think always been, I kind of recognize when that myself and David seem to be really good at doing two groups of songs. I mean, we've written so many songs over the years, even ones that have not seen the light of day, and it likely won't see the light of day for a while. But there seems to be two groups, and I started noticing that it was never intentional. It just was the way that, you know, the ship steered that way or the ship steered that way, depending on the time of year that we wrote the songs, the space we were in, whatever, you know. And I started to think to myself, what would it be like if we took control of that ship and steered it in a certain way and said, right, let's try and do this? Because we'd never ever written like that before. We never gave ourselves an urge to write something, if that makes sense. So it was like the idea of Daylight was, to me, a summer album feels like, you know, when you were young and you had those dance set record players, as they call them. I mean, some people call them, I remember there's other names for them, but I had an Alba dance set, and you would pile as many 7 inches on as you could, and they would just drop one after the other. And I
Yes,
always loved that rush, you know, that audio rush, which people try to, you know, playlists are like nothing like it because it's physical, you know, and eventually there's too many records and they start, you know, they start messing up and things. But there's just that idea of compiling bunches of tracks that feel like a rush. And I think we started speaking about that a lot. And it was really strange because when we started writing Daylight, the songs that we started with steered us in a certain way. And then suddenly, like I would say, like 25% into making these tracks, suddenly there was this explosion happened. And it was like everything we made from that point started to sound like that album. And it was just like, oh my God, what's happening here? I mean, we were like, both of us were like kids, like children, like messaging each other on WhatsApp, going, oh my God, I just listened to that. Oh my God, I just, you know, and it was getting incredibly exciting. And which is, you know, once that dies in making music, you shouldn't be making music. But to still have that rush of energy that we were, it didn't feel like we were in control of it. It felt like something had happened between the two of us and we knew exactly what we had to do, and that was it. Let's just do this. Let's just go with it and see what happens. And we went with it, and we've ended up with an absolutely stunning album because of it. And we have done the exact same thing with Twilight as well. Twilight is just, you know, it's two albums that sometimes you listen to and you think, like, where the hell did these come from? You know, they just, they feel kind of, I'm not a religious person, but there's like, it's something quite godsend about the two of them. They just feel like we,
You channeled
it just
something.
feels like the, no, it just feels like the synchronicity between the two of
Okay.
us. We know exactly all of a sudden what turns us on. And
Yes.
I think as times went on, what turns us on is getting closer and closer to where we just, you know, it's just a spark. I mean,
Okay.
like, I absolutely love this. It's what I live for, is the creating of the songs that we write. That is what it's all about, and it's such an experience. Like, nobody can touch that experience. Nobody outside of the two of us will ever know what that feels like. And it's such a beautiful feeling. And I'm beyond proud of these two albums, and I know David is too.
Well, I'm excited to hear the new one coming out shortly. So you've referenced these in a different ways as we've been chatting. Now, I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's an expression of thank you to you guys for all the hard work. It's an energy exchange. I love the journey of the choice, the receiving, the unpacking, the booklets, the playing the songs from one to whatever number. I'm sure you guys, or I'm not sure if you guys are aware that physical CDs, vinyls, 'cause even cassettes, can you believe, are making a massive comeback. Last year in the UK alone, 5.9 million vinyls, the biggest since 1990, 'cause a CD is on the upward trajectory again. But we've also got these sort of streaming platforms that people consume music on. David, you first, what is your observation of where the industry is at the moment and the digital streaming versus the physical?
I was having a conversation about this today, and it was very much about the beginning of the internet, as it were, and then that massive impact that Facebook had and Twitter. And there was this period where it was a honeymoon and it was all lovely. It was artistic, creative independence. We don't have to like take our records to the man no more.
Yes.
We can democratize, we can form networks in cyberspace and people power and all of that. And then fast forward 15 years or so, and suddenly it's been this really, suddenly now we understand it. But actually, our data has been collected, archived, and sold already. And I think that there was a period of innocence when YouTube first happened. It was like, whoa, look at this amazing site. You can hear old footage and see live footage, and it's all on there. And I remember my partner beginning to listen to YouTube on Saturday nights. You know, Kenny would just like get at YouTube and like have a YouTube session, usually ending up in like really obscure European 80s music. Which is where I learned a lot of it, and I think it's one of the reasons that I was able to respond to the music that Sean did for Daylight so well, because in many ways it was like I'd done my homework, because I was out of the country from 78 to 87, so I missed that whole period. And in many ways, I think that a lot of the flavors that were stimulating Sean on this out on Daylight spoke to that. But in terms of the streaming and the YouTube, I think it's good and evil. I mean, I do have Spotify playlists. I do pay for it. I also pay for YouTube, because I like to watch lectures and things, and you know, I can't stand the ads. But at the same time, there's that Joni Mitchell thing. I have the albums,
Yes.
and I listen, so I feel okay about listening to Billie Holiday or Joni Mitchell or Lana Del Rey. But then there are some records that I don't have access to physically that I can find in cyberspace. And I think it's going to work itself out. Ultimately, I hope it will. I know that the PRS and institutions like that are working really hard to like make sure that artists get their rights. I think it's a really, really valuable resource. I think it's also very problematic. I think that you know, as an internet consumer, and particularly with what Sean and I do, we have to be on the internet. We have to be aware. I mean, I think it's a necessary evil for now.
Interesting. Sean, your observations?
I come from a different angle because I run the record label that we release our music on, and it just feels such a machine that you have to find your own space in, if that makes sense. I mean, I find it really hard, distinguishing between when art is art and it just becomes data. That's the
Yes.
pro That's the problem I have when the art becomes data. And the data becomes a code, and I have to deal with codes of songs that I've, been partly written with my friend. And it's like, the song's no longer talked about as a song, but it's got a UPC code and things. And it makes you start to realize the machine that you became part of just to get heard. But in a way, that's the same as back in the day. You know, all vinyl records had a serial number. It's no any different. But the difference is now I can do it from this computer. We can make a record on this computer, and then we can put this record on this computer into the world to hear. But the issue I have is the firewall that stops us getting heard by anybody else. You know, it's like when you start hearing facts like every month on Spotify, there's 5 million tracks. I've not even had one play because it's so easy just to put data onto these sites. And the data usually is, I mean, there's even people putting up 30-second tracks now just to get clicks. It's just clickbait. And it's really hard to try and distinguish between what you're doing and what they're doing and how you fit into that. And when you think about it too much, it starts destructing what you're doing, because when you start thinking about it too much, you start thinking like, well, what we are doing is on the same worth of that, which it isn't, obviously. I think what's going to happen, and it's funny you were talking about this, because Spotify made an announcement, or the guy who owns it, and he started moaning about what's the future of this, because he's seeing that the amount of stuff that's just getting thrown onto, you know, onto his network is no longer just music. It's just like somebody on TikTok dancing with a dog, and then they put that 30-second bit of soundtrack on Spotify. So there's at some point there's going to have to be some kind of like a shit filter filtering this stuff out and letting, just allowing music to go through. And like they're saying now, if you haven't had a play in a month or two, they're going to start deleting things, which is kind of good and kind of not good, because then it's starting to police people's music. And there's nothing to say that that record might not get played in the future. But my issue is record shops usually only get records in that they either like or they think they're going to sell. Most record shops, even to this day, like I know, for instance, my favorite record shop in Glasgow, Monorail, they kind of veto everything that gets through and that they sell. So people know that's where I can go to get good records, and I know what taste they have. I would like to see that kind of move over into the digital service providers. I think people like Apple and Tidal have got a much better reputation than Spotify, because they're slightly more music based and only take in music, whereas Spotify is all, you know, everything, podcasts, audiobooks, da da da. And as data becomes more and more, it's kind of crazy the amount of gigs of information that are just getting crammed every second onto these things, and they're just getting bigger and bigger. So it's going to get harder and harder to find stuff that you like. So then
Absolutely.
they're going to have to work out a way, you know, there needs to be a way forward where I think personally the music side of Spotify needs to be a bit stricter to what they actually let through the door in the first place.
Okay, so guys, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So, David, as a final message, what would you like to say?
I'd like to say that it's summertime and we've just made a perfect album for this time of year, wherever you are in the world.
Yeah,
Brilliant.
I agree with that. It's summer somewhere in the world. It's kind of, what's that saying about this? It's 5 o'clock somewhere in the world to have a drink. That's where I think of it. Somewhere in the world is always going to be summer. It was funny because the guy that we work with and it does our American-based radio stuff, I had this conversation with him, and he said, "You're really obsessed with a summer thing." And I'm like, "You live in Los Angeles. You always have sunshine." He said, "We only get it for this period of time, so that's why we're trying to make a thing about it." And he went, "Okay, I get it now. Okay." So, like, somewhere in the world it's always summer, but somewhere in the world it's always winter. So yeah, and we've I think we've beautifully damped both those feelings onto two records.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.